Well, good afternoon, everybody. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. You have created all things so that we can come home, Abba. I pray that you will bless us today and that all the words that come out of my mouth will be from you, and that anything that I say from me will fall on the ground and die. And I ask for your presence in this meeting in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. All right, well, the name of my teaching website is themessianicmessage.com. And as always, please be a Berean. You know, just because I'm up here saying it doesn't mean that you don't have work to do to verify and even correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to teach on the kingdom of Edom, the enemy we face. You know, little did I know, in 2009, two things happened. One is I started this website called BeastWatchNews.com. And, you know, the Lord gave me that name, and I kept trying to change the name, and I kept going back to it. You know how the Lord is. He's very persistent. And when I was doing this website, simultaneously with that, the Lord gave me a teaching called the Esau Effect. How many in here have ever heard of the Esau Effect? It's a three-part teaching. Each part is about an hour long. And I examine Esau in about every way that Esau can be examined. Now, we have in the Hebrew Roots community been tracing our roots, our Jacob roots, but for some reason the Lord just has laid it on me to keep tracing Esau. Where's he going? What's he done in the past? What's he going to do in the future? And that is what we're going to learn today. We're going to learn that the Great Tribulation is actually the final battle of the birthright war between Jacob and Esau. But we have to identify Esau, and we have to find out where he emigrated in order for us to understand what's going on here at the end of days. We're going to define the term beast. You're going to understand what a beast is. Understanding the eight sieges of Jerusalem. And you're going to understand why Esau is Islam and why Islam is the eighth beast. You know, Laura and I, we watched that blood moon, and we were out there at 3:30 in the morning going, "Oh, it's so pretty. Oh, watch that. Oh, that's so nice." And she goes, "Yeah, it's a rare one." And I went, "Stop the presses. What do you mean it's a rare one?" She goes, "Oh, yeah, there's going to be a sunrise, you know, with this blood moon." She says, "It rarely happens." Well, it turns out, you see, what I've been teaching for the last 5 years is that the Great Tribulation is the rise of both nations at the same time. It's the rise of Esau and Jacob at the same time, and that's what this battle is going to be. And so, you can see here that the sun is symbolized as the Father, we know that, but it also symbolizes the Gentile nations. Now, you know that Esau was born a Hebrew, but you do know that he crossed over the other direction. You know, he converted the other way. So he is like the father of the Gentiles almost. So we have the rise of the sun and the moon, which symbolizes mother, but also Israel. And in the Mississippi River Valley, in the United States, they stood in the sky together. And as far as I was concerned, that clinched it for me. I've been saying this for 5 years. Now I know, with this recent blood moon, this is what's happening. Jacob's government is rising, you know, we're being gathered, and Esau's government is rising at the same time, and that's what the Great Tribulation is all about. You know, the Lord does not give me this message to scare y'all. No, this message is an encouragement to you. You know, when I was a kid in the church and the preacher, you know, did the hellfire damnation thing and, you know, scaring us about the beast that was coming and was going to trample the earth and all of that, it was very scary. But what he wants us to know is what he's going to do. The Lord has always kept his people informed. He said, I don't do anything but what I tell my prophets what I'm going to do, right? And so all we have to do is go back in Scripture and see what he's going to do. So this is to keep you informed. It's to fulfill the Lord's will in that regard. But also, when you're going to go to war, you need to know your enemy. You need to know who you're going to fight or who you're going to flee from, right? Well, we're not going to fight this one. The Messiah from Abraham through Isaac through Jacob through Judah is coming back to fight this arch enemy of Jacob. He's coming back. He's going to do this for us. But you and I are going to flee. Now tomorrow, I'm going to tell you where we're going to flee to and how we're going to get to Israel. I'm even going to give you hope about your children. The Lord has a plan for your children. You know, the ones that you walk away from going into the camps of the righteous. You're going to find out a lot more about that tomorrow. We're going to start with the birthright war that began at the conception of Esau and Jacob. You see here it says, the children struggled together within her, and she went to ask the Lord. And he said, two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people. They're two totally different people, Esau and Jacob. And one people will be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Esau and Jacob were fighting in the womb when they were seeds, and they were fighting when they were exiting the womb, you see? And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb, and after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel. You know, I talk about this in the Esau effect, but you know why Jacob was holding Esau's heel? Because Esau was kicking his head. Esau was trying to kill Jacob as they were exiting the womb. By the way, they were babies. Now, here at the end, they're not only full-grown men, they're fully developed nations. Esau sold his birthright. And this is a review. I know you guys all know this stuff. We're going to get to the new stuff here in a minute. But we have to associate Esau with... Whoops. Boy, you know what? I do this all the time. We have to associate Esau with being red. Now, I'm going to tell you more about this. Okay, point it that way. Okay. You have to associate Esau with red, and I'm going to talk about this episode in greater detail later in the teaching. Now, Esau, again, said that, you know, in that episode that he was at the point to die. And that's an important thing that we need to understand. Why was Esau about to die? So later on, I'm going to explain that. But Esau came out red all over. He ate that red pottage, and his name became Edom, which means red. Red is a sign of war and judgment. You know, those blood moons, that's what they mean. The dragon of Revelation is red. So are you starting to see how Esau and the dragon are related to each other? The fight between Esau and Jacob is over the birthright and the blessing. Lord Isaac gave Jacob this blessing, that God would give Jacob the dew of the heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of corn and wine. The people would serve him and nations would bow down to him. He would be Lord over his brethren, and his mother's sons would bow down to him. Cursed would be everyone that cursed him, and blessed would be he that blessed Jacob. But here's what Esau got. Esau got to dwell at the fatness of the earth. See, he's dwelling in the fatness of the earth, in the dew of the heaven. Jacob owns that, but Esau gets to dwell there. Well, now, for an egotistical maniac, that's a bad deal, you see. So he don't want to have anything to do with that. And furthermore, it says here that by his sword he would live, and that he would serve his brother, see, Jacob. But here is the prophecy part. It says, it shall come to pass when you have the dominion that you shall break his, that's Jacob's, yoke from off your neck. And so we are at the time that I believe when Esau is breaking the yoke of Jacob from his neck. And by the way, I do believe that Barack Obama is the one who has been anointed and appointed to break that yoke. Esau threatened to kill Jacob. Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing. And so he wanted to kill Jacob. He ran Jacob out of the land of his inheritance. Rebekah had to tell her only son, the one of the tenth. I mean, Esau was her son too, but the only one that she had that was like her and Isaac, she had to tell him to leave the land of his inheritance. And Esau preempted Jacob by setting up a nation, okay? Now, in Genesis 36:1, I have in the other teaching, the Esau effect, a lot more information on this, but I'm going to go through here quickly. These are the generations of Esau, who is Edom, that's red. And thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir, that word Seir means hairy. Esau is Edom. The Lord wants you to associate Esau with being red and with that word Seir. We're going to get to that. Going down to verse 10 in Genesis 36, it says, these are the names of Esau's sons, Eliphaz and Reuel. And what are the grandsons' name? Well, they're Teman, Omar, Zepho. We're going to look at that guy in a little bit. Gatam, Kenaz, Amalek, Nahath, Zerah, Shema, Mizah, Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. In the very next verse, we find that these same guys are their dukes. That word there means chieftain. They were in the government within one generation. He went over there with his two sons to Mount Seir. They had children, and within one generation, they took over Mount Seir, where the Horites live. You know, they do that today, don't they? They kind of move in, they buy up the 7-Elevens and the Super 8 motels, and the next thing you know, they're presidents of the United States, right? So we've already seen that this is an MO for them. And you see down here in Genesis 36:20, it says here, these are the generations of the Horite king. That's like a eulogy there. That guy got run off. We read in the book of Deuteronomy about the war between Esau and the Horite king, but they ran him out of their own country. Now, down in Genesis 36:31, it talks about these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. See what I told you? Esau tries to preempt Jacob as he goes along. It says, and Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom. Oh, by the way, that guy Bela, you know him as Balaam. You know the donkey guy? Yeah, that's Balaam. We're going to learn more about him a little bit later. You're going to understand why Balak wanted Balaam's favor. And it says, Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozra, reigned in his stead. And Jobab died, and Husham of the land of Timani reigned in his stead. And Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who smote Midian, you know, he reigned, and then he died, and Samla took over. And then Samla died, and Saul of Rehoboth died, and Saul reigned in his stead. And then we had Baal-Hanan, and then Baal-Hanan, and the son of Achbor died, and Hadar reigned in his stead. Does anybody see a kind of an odd thing about that list. They're not related exactly right. You know, there are three ways that you get a new leader when the king dies. If it's a monarchy, there's a succession. If there's not a monarchy and you're looking at, you know, maybe these were, they broke up into little tribes or something, you know, then there would be wars, right? The other way that you get a leader is you vote. You vote for your leaders. I'm going to show you that Esau is the father of voting. Okay, he's the guy that created this democracy thing that everybody's so proud of. Esau was in Cyprus. Now, I use the book of Jasher to fill in details that I don't get in the book of Genesis and Exodus. And the reason I do that is because Jasher was part of our canon. It was removed in the, I believe, the late 1800s, early 1900s. It tells us a lot about things that, you know, we just don't have the details of in the book of Genesis. By the way, Jasher is mentioned in the book of Joshua and in 2 Samuel. So this is not a book that, you know, doesn't have some validation behind it and some credibility. It says, in those days died Zepho. Remember I told you I was going to tell you about Zepho? He's the son of Eliphaz. Eliphaz is the oldest son of Esau, and he was king of Kittim. Now, what is Kittim? Does anybody know? It's Cyprus. Kittim is the old name for the Cyprus, the nation of Cyprus today. And the time that Zepho reigned over the children of Kittim was 50 years. Look, Zepho was one of the grandsons that became a chieftain in Mount Seir. And what did he do? They go over to the island of Cyprus, which is not too far off the coast of Israel there, you know, out in the Mediterranean Sea. And he becomes the king over there. They migrated over there. And by the way, we're going to find out that Greece is just another step across that pond, okay? And Janaeus, one of the mighty men of the children of Kittim, reigned after him, and he reigned 50 years. And it was after the death of the king of Kittim that Balaam, the son of Beor, fled from the land of Kittim, and he went to Egypt to be with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now, keep that in mind, because that's going to be a part of your puzzle piece for later on. Esau is the he-goat of Greece, and I'm going to show you that right now. Daniel chapter 8, verses 5 and 8 says, "And I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole ground and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." So we know that this is Greece. After Alexander the Great conquered the Levant, he died, and that kingdom was split up into four parts. We're going to look at the... Remember, Esau is Seir. He's hairy. Esau is Seir at the Mount Seir. You remember, we're going to look at this Seir because being Edom and being Seir are two of the characteristics you need to know about Esau. This word here, Seir, is actually, it's a root word, but it does mean hairy. It means a he-goat. It says here a sacrificial animal as well, but here's the part I want you to pay attention. He is a demon-possessed goat. Seir, the man, is hairy. You see this root word right here, 8163. And that is the same word as the Mount Seir, which comes from the root word Seir. So Esau is both a man and a nation. He's a man and a nation, and I want you to keep that in mind as we go forward. Here are the meanings for Seir. It means hair in general. It also means hairy as an adjective. The masculine noun denotes a he-goat. See, he is Seir. He is a he-goat. You see this? The feminine noun means barley. It means the bearded grain. In my teaching in the Esau Effect, I talk about how there are 13 types of grasses, and one of them is the poisonous bearded grain that comes up with it comes up with the wheat. It's the tares among the wheat. And that parable that Yeshua gave us comes from Isaac's blessings, where that blessing means that Esau is going to be wherever Jacob is. And so here we see that there's this bearded grain. And by the way, you can't tell what is a tare and what is a wheat until the time of the harvest. That's why the Lord said you can't just go out there and tear them up. You have to let him come and do that, because you have to be able to identify them, and they're very hard to identify. But here is a big identifier for you. This bearded grain, which, by the way, if you get it in your wheat, that bearded grain is toxic, poisonous. It'll kill you if you eat it. That's why you've got to get it out of the wheat. But it stands straight up. The head of it looks like a wheat, except that it stands straight up at harvest, while the wheat bows over. You see, that's the difference between the two of them. Then we have the masculine noun sar, which means horror. We also have czars in Russia, and we have czars in the White House now. And this denominative verb sa'ar means to be very afraid. And may I suggest to you that the sa'ir sa'ar, the hairy he-goat, wants you to be very afraid. Now, we're not going to do that. We're just not going to, we don't play that game. We're the children of Abraham. We're the children of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right? So we're not playing that game. But there's one more thing that I want you to understand about the word Seir. Here it's pronounced Sha'ar. And it means to calculate or reckon, okay? Now, in Revelation 13:18, it says, "Here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding count the number of the beast." Here is the Thayer's definition of the Greek word for count. It's sophizo, and it means to count with pebbles, to compute, to calculate, to reckon, and to decide by voting. Here comes that voting thing again. Now, we're going to take a look at Esau and the Roman Empire before we move any further, because many Western and Jewish historians claim that Rome is Edom, and it's also the wellspring of the Roman Catholic Church. Edomites are believed to have been widely dispersed into Rome after the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD, which is long before the Catholic Church was fought. Some historians will tell you that there were already Edomites in Rome, and that the southern Italian population actually are Arabs. They're actually Edomites. We have Rome historically associated with Esau. And by the way, the Romans, like the Greeks, became associated with the wild boar, which is a pig. You know, in the prodigal son parable, it says that the prodigal son was with the swine. And we have two places where we have Catholicism. We have Greek Orthodox and we have Roman Catholic. The Greek church, very much associated with the wild boar. Roman church, very much associated with the wild boar. And that's where the prodigal son has been hiding out. Edom was involved in the destruction of the first temple because they took advantage of, you know, when the Babylonians came down, Esau came in there and seized control of parts of Judah. It tells us that in Ezekiel 25:12, 35:5, verse 10. And verse 2 here it says, and then Obadiah, verses 11 to 16. Edom also took part in the destruction of the second Jerusalem temple. And I'm going to read Psalm 137:7. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who is to be destroyed? Daughter of Babylon, Rome. Happy shall he be that rewards you as he has served us. And then in Obadiah chapter 1, which is the only chapter, verse 11, in the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces and foreign entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them. So when Jerusalem was attacked, Obadiah tells us that Esau was there attacking, you see? So we have Esau is confederate with the armies that came against Jerusalem. For as you have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. So we're going to define the beast. What is a beast? We're going to find out that a biblical beast definition is, it can be both a foreign nation that has conquered and occupied Jerusalem, and it can also be a man. You just have to read the scripture and get the context to find out whether the Lord is saying this is a beast government or it's a beast man. We're going to look at how I arrived at that definition. In Daniel chapter 7, verses 2 and 3, Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man. Remember Nebuchadnezzar's statue? This beast morphed from the lion with the eagle's wings into a man. That's one of the clues that we have. And it says a man's heart was given to it. Here is the probably the most famous statue of the ancient Babylonian Empire. By the way, I think this statue was destroyed by ISIL. And you can see here that the Babylonian Empire occupied and controlled Jerusalem. Now we're going to look at Medo-Persia. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, raised itself up on one side and had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Here's the bear, and here's the empire. You see? Again, controlling Jerusalem. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. See, there's the leper with the four wings and the four heads, depicting how Greece would be split up into four kingdoms. Here is the map of the Greek Empire, again occupying and controlling Jerusalem. You see, there's a theme with this thing, isn't there? Rome. Let's look at this Roman beast, because we're going to find out that this beast doesn't just represent Rome. One of the debates online is it Rome or is it the end time beast? And the answer is yeah. Yes, it is. So we're going to look at that. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth that devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse. It was different than all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Here is the depiction of that Roman beast. Here is the map. I know you can't see that red circle there very well, but you can see that it controlled Jerusalem. Before these four beasts arose and took over Jerusalem, which were Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, before those happened, there were two other empires that are beast empires, Egypt and Assyria. And we know that Egypt was in control of the area of Jerusalem during the time of the Exodus. Assyria came down and took the 10 northern tribes captive before the Babylonian exile. And then after the Roman beast, there's going to be a seventh beast and an eighth beast. I'm going to show that to you. Here is the Egyptian Empire where it controlled Jerusalem. Here is the Assyrian Empire, excuse me, where it controlled Jerusalem. So we have the eight sieges of Jerusalem. We've had seven already. We're going to get the eighth one very soon. In Revelation 17:10, the Lord said, "There are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is." Now, John was on the Isle of Patmos when he got this vision. And so there's John. He is in Rome. He's in the sixth one, you see. But Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo, Persia, and Greece, they had already fallen. And the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast, the seventh one, that was, now, this looks a little confusing, because what the Lord has done here is he has taken John into the future after the seventh beast fell. And John is seeing this seventh beast as if it has fallen now. And so, and the beast, the seventh that was, because he arose and now he is not, because he can only continue for a short space. You see this continuing for a short space. He's continuing for a short while. Even he is the eighth. Now, before I go on to any further thing, the eighth beast is going to be just like the seventh on steroids and is of the seven. He's going to have attributes not only of that former seventh beast, but he's going to have attributes of all of the other previous sevens. See? Which is why we have coming on us not only Islam, but Islam is going to look like Egypt and Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. It looks like it's all that, all those beasts are now coming enveloped in one beast called the eighth beast in the book of Revelation. Now, we're going to take a look at the seventh beast, because after the Roman Empire fell, the next empire that took over Jerusalem was Islam. You see here, see the red mark there, controlling Israel. See the red mark there, controlling Israel. See the Ottoman Empire, controlling Israel. But by 1920, that beast had been wounded. You remember it says that the beast has a wound? That beast was wounded because at the Balfour Declaration in 1917, they began dismantling this empire. And so now it's just, you know, what it is. It's whatever's left of it. Not much now. But a man can be called a beast. Now, I just showed you the definition of a beast as an empire, as a nation that occupies and controls Jerusalem. Did everybody understand that? Raise your hand if you understand that definition. Okay. Now we're going to see how a beast is called a man. You remember when the beast of Babylon rose up out of the sea and it came up as a lion with eagle's wings, and then it stood up on its feet and it became a man because it was given a man's heart. You remember that? Well, we're going to tie that in. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he asked Belteshazzar, which is the Babylonian name of Daniel. He asked Daniel to show him the interpretation of the dream. And Daniel said, "This is the interpretation, O king, that they will drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you're going to eat grass like an oxen, and you're going to be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 years will pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whoever he will." So Nebuchadnezzar had to learn a lesson that the Lord is actually the one that's in control. So exactly 1 year later, Nebuchadnezzar is walking in the palace of Babylon, and he said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" And the Lord said to him, "Oh, King Nebuchadnezzar, ooh, buddy, you're in for it. To thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from you." That same hour, Nebuchadnezzar was driven from his men. He ate grass as an oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers. Remember those eagle's wings on the back of that statue? And his nails like bird's claws. So now we see that there's a connection between Nebuchadnezzar, the beast man, and Daniel's fourth beast, which is Rome because of those claws, and the beast of Revelation of Islam because of the horns. And there it goes. Now we're going to compare these beasts, because in Revelation 13, verse 2, it says, "And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority." Leopard is the Greece. The bear is Medo-Persia. The lion is Babylon. We don't see Rome. Why don't we see Rome in this? Well, because she has now been shifted to another role in the scripture. She is now, O daughter of Babylon. She is the great whore now, which rides the beast. Okay? But I didn't have time to go into all of that for this teaching. I have to stick with, you know, what I'm doing here. In Ezekiel, it says, or this book is called Ezekiel, a commentary anthologized from Talmudic, Midrashic, and Rabbinic sources. Jewish rabbis and sages have long realized that the final ten-horned kingdom... By the way, you do know that the rabbis know about this end-time beast? They say that it's going to be an Arab or Middle Eastern origin. And here's the quote. "The Midrash comments that these ten horns symbolize 10 kings of the fourth kingdom, and the 11th horn is the final king whom Israel will confront. All these kings, the Midrash stresses, are to be descendants of Esau." The Jews know who this is. The implication is that the king and initiator of the campaign against Israel will be from Esau or Edom. That comes out of the Art Scroll Tanakh series. Now, so we're going to compare the beasts again. Daniel's fourth beast, Rome, has 10 horns and 10 claws. Nebuchadnezzar had 10 toes and 10 claws. And the beast of Revelation has 7 heads and 10 horns. Do you see how they're all connected by little other, like the 10 horns of Revelation and the 10 horns of Rome? And then you have the claws of Rome and Nebuchadnezzar, and they're all going to... By the time we're done with this, you're going to understand how they all have something to do with each other. It says in Revelation 13:4 that they worshipped the dragon which gave power to the beast, And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? You know, I've had a couple of occasions in Beast Watch News to make my little red comment after the headline, which would read something like, Who's going to be able to stop this beast? You know, they're saying this in the news. And I always quote from here, Who can make war with the beast? So we're going to look at who or what is the dragon. The dragon is mentioned 13 times in Revelation. At the end of the Great Tribulation, he's bound and thrown into the pit for 1,000 years. And in 20 verse 2, it says, And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil. Okay, so now we know that the dragon is the devil, and Satan is his other name. How do they worship the dragon, Satan, the beast? They worship him via the name Allah. By the way, the Hebrew word Allah is a primitive root word meaning to adjure or imprecate or curse or swear. But Strong's 423 means curse and cursing, execration, oath, and swearing. The name of Allah to us is a curse. You see, they're worshiping that. They're worshiping that which curses us. Here's a Bismillah. Bismillah means in the name of Allah. And so now you see these are all kind of stylized Bismillahs. I mean, if you saw one of these, you're not a Muslim, you wouldn't understand what that is. They know what these are. I want to show you this one, though. You see this body, and you see the long neck, you see the head. This is a stylized Bismillah made to look like a serpent. And they've also made one to look like a phoenix. This is a phoenix Bismillah. Because ancient Greece finally gave up its association with its other animal and took up the phoenix as its national symbol. So let's take a look at what John saw. This is from the Codex Vaticanus, and this is the oldest known manuscript to exist of the book of Revelation. And so here's what they do. They say, okay, this is the chi, this is the she, and this is the stigma, and they translate it as 666. But here's what, if you turn it sideways, here's what it looks like, and if you show that to a Muslim, they'll tell you that's a Bismillah. John was seeing a Bismillah. He was telling us what to look for. Here's a Bismillah. It's just a plain old Bismillah. Here's what John saw. Here's the Bismillah. It has a little spear in it. But here's this Bismillah. Here's this Bismillah. You see the similarity? By the way, that Bismillah, that's the mark of the beast. Now, the other thing that John saw was it looks like the chi, which is actually an X, you know, in English. But you see the little hilt here, like it's crossed swords? Well, that is the symbol of Islam, these crossed swords. So John saw what could be crossed swords and a Bismillah, you see? 660 and 6. But remember, I told you that we need to calculate or sha'ar that name, and that it's related to the he-goat. And the he-goat is Esau. You see, are you making the connection now that Esau is this he-goat that's in the book of Revelation? So where do they wear this Bismillah? Well, it's worn on the right arm, and it's worn on the right wrist. They even have watches where you don't ever have to be... you don't even have to wear a band. You can just put your jewelry on and wear it that way. And it's also worn on their forehead. This is a headband that they wear, and you can see the crossed swords and the Bismillah there. So it's worn in the forehead and on the right hand. Isn't that what John said that those who worship the beast would do? Would take the mark of the beast? Islam's agenda is to be the last religion. And they say that it means, hear this sentence. I don't even want to say that sentence, but that sentence in English means, "Peace be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings." Isn't that laughable? Okay, one of the things we're going to look at is a quote that I found in a book. You know what, I've got my notes right there, and my brain is not letting me access what the name of this book is. But this guy, Guillaume, in 1987, got his book published regarding Islam in the Oxford University Press. Now, you don't get published at Oxford University Press unless you are a well-respected scholar in your field. And Guillaume says that, Muhammad's features were like Esau's features. He was fair-skinned and was tinged with red, you see? So we have that connection now with the coloring of Esau and the coloring of Muhammad. Now I'm going to go through why we have, in the end of days, why it's Esau and not Ishmael. Esau married into the house of Ishmael. And when he did that, he usurped Ishmael's authority. You know, if you go, I don't know if you have any software, Bible software, but if you put in house of Ishmael, you won't find it. If you put in house of Esau, you'll find it. And so he married into the family, usurped Ishmael's patriarchy in that family. So coming down to modern times, we have Esau and Ishmael. They're together. One is Sunnis and the other one is Shiites. Esau is Sunnis and Ishmael are the Shiites. So we're going to look at what kind of people the Ishmaelites are or the Shiites are. And it says here that he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. You know, what it really says there is that he's going to be like a donkey. he's going to be a stubborn person, and he actually is a stubborn person. Here it says that the Lord said, as for Ishmael, he's talking to Hagar. He says, I have heard you, Hagar. Behold, I have blessed him, Ishmael, and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. And so I'm not going to go into the comparison between the 12 princes of Ishmael and the 12 tribes of Israel in this teaching, but it says here that he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of Egypt. And then later on it says in Genesis 25 verse 6 that Abraham sent gifts over to the land, the eastward land, into the east country, to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac, his son, while he yet lived, eastward to the east country. So where did he send him? He sent those sons of his concubines to the wilderness of Paran. That wilderness there is where the children of Israel passed through there with no trouble. The children of Israel never had a problem with the Ishmaelites living in the wilderness of Paran. Now, they did have trouble with the Edomites, who were practically next door, you see, you know, with Amalek, and they didn't want to give them water or any of that stuff, you see. But there was no problem with the Shiites, by the way, or with the Ishmaelites. By the way, Shiites worldwide have always been willing to live in the same area with Christians and Jews. They've never given the children of Israel any trouble. But then we have this. Psalm 83:6, the tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites. The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites. So the Ishmaelites are with Edom. The Ishmaelites are not their own nation. The Ishmaelites are joined to a nation called Edom. You see this? And there are other people, Moab and the Hagarenes. The Hagar people, they are people that Hagar gave birth to after she went to Egypt. They call themselves the Hagarenes, and Gebal and Ammon, Amalek, and the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. But guess who is joined with Edom and the Ishmaelites there? It's Assyria, which is modern Syria. They are joined with that bunch there that's going to make war against Israel, and they have helped the children of Lot. You see, those are the Lebanese, modern Lebanese. So we have some major alliances that happen that's going to affect us at the end of days. But the big thing to realize is that the Ishmaelites are with the kingdom of Edom, because the Ishmaelites don't have a kingdom of their own, right? So what kind of people are the Edomites, or today's Sunnis? Well, they have no tolerance. They have, in fact, you know, this Wahhabi guy, this Sunni guy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is, by the way, running into Baghdad full-time, trying to set up the caliphate in Baghdad because it's the closest place to Babylon. You're going to understand the Esau-Babylon connection in a little bit. They are killing other Sunnis who disagree with them. They have no tolerance at all. These guys are killing their Shiite brethren. Oh, and by the way, they've been killing their Shiite brethren since, you know, 612, when Muhammad died. They've been at war in, you know, they split into two houses. We're split into two houses, and they've been at war with each other, you see. Kind of, well, it's kind of like us, a little bit away, you know. They are warriors. They live by the sword. They love their sword. And Bonnie the other night taught us about the Assyrians who invented crucifixion. But I'll tell you what, the Edomites, they love it. They love crucifixion. By the way, the Roman soldiers that killed Yeshua on the stake, by the way, they were Edomites. That was, you know, they carried that out of Assyria and right into Rome. And then the number one thing is they love to cut people's heads off. Esau is the father of beheading. It says in Jasher 27:4, on a certain day Esau went in the field to hunt, and he found Nimrod walking in there with two men. And all his mighty men and his people were with him in the wilderness, but they removed at a distance from him. And they went from him in different directions to hunt. And Esau concealed himself from Nimrod, and he lurked for him in the wilderness. By the way, this is an Edomite trait. We just had another Gaza war where we see all these tunnels. They love to dig tunnels. They love to get in the clefts of the rock. They love to hide themselves and pop out and scare you. You know, it's like a horror movie. They love that stuff. And Nimrod and his men that were with him did not know him, that's Esau. And Nimrod and his men frequently walked about in the field at the cool of the day and to know where his men were hunting in the field. And so Nimrod is basically by himself. His two guys are off, you know, chasing their own game. And by the way, the game that they hunted were people. This guy, this mighty hunter, Nimrod, they call him a mighty hunter because he used to capture people and set them loose so that his hunters could go hunt the people. So now we know what kind of guy Nimrod is, right? And Esau started suddenly from his lurking place and drew his sword. See, he's already living by his sword. And he hurried and ran to Nimrod and cut off his head. This is the first known beheading. Now, we're going to look at the genocides of the Edomites, and I'm going to show you about Balaam. Remember I told you that Balaam, the son of Beor, there was something you need to know about him? Well, you know, he was over there with the Pharaoh, and, you know, he was some kind of a big celebrity. Apparently, he could, you know, he was a king and a priest, and they liked him a lot. And so, you know, they came from everywhere to learn his wisdom And the king, that's Pharaoh, said to Balaam, and what shall we do to Israel? You remember this story from the first Exodus? And Balaam says, if it please the king, let him order all their children, which shall be born from this day forward, to be thrown into the water. For by this you can wipe away their name, for none of them nor their fathers were tried in this manner. By the way, you know that the Red Sea was a trial by water, right? And you know what they used to do is take people. If they, you know, if you drowned, then you were guilty. If you lived, then you were exonerated, right? That's why it was so important for the people to go through the Red Sea. The Lord had to exonerate the entire nation. You see, going through the Red Sea. And the king heard the words of Balaam, and it pleased the king. And the king did according to the word of Balaam. That's where Pharaoh got the idea about throwing the male Hebrew children into the river. Now we have Doeg. You remember when David was running from King Saul and he went to Nob and he saw those priests and they helped him? And Saul found out about it, right? And he said to Doeg, the Edomite, you see, Doeg is the Edomite. He says, go over there and, you know, kill those priests that helped David. And so Doeg goes over there and he kills 85 that wore the linen ephod. Okay? But he didn't stop there. He killed everybody, men, women, children, sucklings, and all of their clean animals. Haman, we all know that story. And what do we say when we hear that word? Boo. Okay. So we know that, and Haman was an Edomite. A lot of people don't know that. Amalek tried to kill the children of Israel in the wilderness. Herod. Our King James Bibles say that Herod was an Idumean. Idumean is Greek for Edomite. Now, you're probably wondering how Greek Edomite rose to power in the Roman Empire. Well, here's what happened. About 135 years before Yeshua was born, there was an uprising between the Hasmoneans, John Hyrcanus II, and the Edomites. And finally, Judah won the day, and they captured all those Edomites, and they brought them wholesale right into Jerusalem. And they took them to the temple, and they forcibly circumcised all the Edomite men that they captured. And they forcibly converted them to Judaism. Bad idea. Because in amongst the Jews today are Edomites. And I've got news for you. They have very long memories. You see, we tend not to have very long memories because we're forgiving, right? Esau is not forgiving. Other red people, other Edomites you might know, are Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Ernesto or Che Guevara of Argentina. You know, Hitler, you know, is registered, you know, everybody thinks he's a Christian, but he's part Jewish. He's one of those Edomites, you know, that, you know, where the Edomites passed this hatred of Jews all the way down through history. But we see that what we're looking at here are genocides. And by the way, these guys, even though Hitler is kind of a religious person on the surface, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Guevara, they are not religious at all. But what are they? They're communists. Make the connection. Secular Esau is red. Communism is red. So now we're going to look at what does Esau have to do with Babylon? Because I've tied everything together except we got Babylon hanging out here. We don't know what Esau has to do with Babylon. Well, I'm going to show you right now. Esau killed Nimrod, but he never reigned as king. You know, when you kill the king, you get to go and sit on his throne. And so Esau is trying to occupy two thrones at the same time. He wants that Babylonian throne, and he wants the Jerusalem throne. So he wants to have a blend. This is why we're getting Chrislam now. See, he's trying to blend Babylon with Islam. And so, you know, when Esau came running in and he said, you know, I'm just famished. I need some of that red pottage and I need it now. What was happening on that day was that Abraham had died and Isaac was grieving for Abraham. And the job of the firstborn son was to make the comfort meal, which was the red lentil stew. And Esau was off in the field hunting and beheading Nimrod. Well, after he beheaded Nimrod, he had a moment of fear. And rather than going and taking the throne of Babylon, he ran from Nimrod's other two men. And by the time he got home, he thought, man, I'm about to die anyway. And I'm wore out. And, you know, I don't care. Here, have the birthright. See? Because he thought that it was going to be useless to him anyway. He thought those guys were coming after him. Well, it turns out that they didn't. But that's why you have the connection between Esau and Nimrod. Now he has to fulfill his obligation to sit on Nimrod's throne. Now we're going to look at the seventh beast and the caliphates. You know, the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel tell us that this beast has 10 horns. And here are the 10 horns. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then there's one that comes up, and it's their prophesied Mahdi. For centuries, people have been trying to put together who these 10 horns are. And I just have never believed anybody's list. Everybody's got a different list of kings and emperors of Rome and just who are the nations. And when I saw this list, I went, oh man, there it is. There's the 10 horns of the seventh beast. And here is their agenda. And you'll see on here that they've got the earth divided up into 10 kingdoms. By the way, you know, that beast that rises up out of the sea, and you do know that the sea is a symbol for the people. The beast rises up out of the people. That beast has 7 heads. And on that beast sits 10 horns. What are the 7 heads? They are 7 continents. 7 continents, 10 horns, and you will see that some of these continents have, here's two, you see? So they've divided up the world. This picture right here came out of a story about a month or 6 weeks ago. This is what the Islamic State of Islam and in the Levant put out. ISIL put this story out. This is what they intend to do. This is the eighth beast rising. And I put that picture in Beast Watch News. Some of you, if you pay attention to Beast Watch at all, you might have seen that one day. And so the Mahdi is in Daniel 7:8. He said, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. What is that talking about? Who's being plucked up by the roots? I'm going to tell you who they are right now. They're Iraq, Iran, and Syria. And you know why they're being plucked up by the roots? You know why they're fighting in Iraq and Syria right now, and they're going to go after Iran? You know why? It's because those are only 3 Shiite-controlled nations on the earth. Sunnis hate Shiites. And they're trying to bring Bashar al-Assad down. Now, he's an Alawite, which is another sect of the Shiites. But they're trying to destroy those 3 Shiite-controlled nations. And according to the book of Daniel, they accomplish that. They pluck them right up by the roots. And apparently, this plucking up by the roots is going to come before the person with the horn that has eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. That is probably going to happen before the Mahdi appears, that they're going to get rid of all the Shiite nations. Now we're going to identify the Antichrist. The beast man and the Antichrist are the same entity because the beast man rules the beast government. The beast man and the beast government both come from Esau. Now, I don't know if this current configuration of the beast is going to last. They could be defeated. They could, you know, regroup and come back again. But I will tell you this, I think they're here to stay. No matter how long it takes for them to accomplish their goals, I think we're going to continue to see ISIL slash ISIS. And here's the difference between ISIL and ISIS. ISIS operates in the Syrian arena. It's the Islamic State in Syria. ISIL is the Islamic State in the Levant, which is all that land area that controls Jerusalem, okay? So the Levant to them is not just there in the Middle East in getting control of Jerusalem and Israel and that area. They're going after the whole world, and they're going to start there in the Middle East. But ISIL operates in the Levant. ISIS operates in Syria. So Esau's agenda is to rule as king in Babylon and in Jerusalem. Babylon is the religious system. It's Islam and Catholicism blended together. The caliphate is their governing legal system, and the law system is called Sharia. So the Great Tribulation is the final battle of the birthright war. And we've identified Esau. I've shown you where Esau emigrated to, how they went to Cyprus and to Greece, and they went to Rome, and they're even having something to do with Medo-Persia. And I've defined the term beast. You now know that we're looking at the eighth siege of Jerusalem, and it's the final one. And you now understand why Esau is Islam and why Islam is the eighth beast. And then tomorrow afternoon, come back here because I'm going to give you the rest of the story and tell you what happy ending it has. I'm going to show you the timeline for going through the Great Tribulation, and then we're going to go right into the kingdom and show you what kind of a kingdom, and you're going to be surprised at some things. But again, there is one big, big, big ray of hope in there for us that has to do with our sons and daughters, the ones that we prayed for two nights here in this tabernacle. All right, well, I appreciate your time and attention. I hope this was informative for you, and shalom. Yeah, we have time for Q&A. Okay.
Kimberly, I just want to very much compliment you.
Yeah, I really want to compliment you. It's an extraordinary presentation that you've done here, and you've done some incredible research. It's eye-opening. I think we've all learned from it. Now, I have a presentation tonight, and in many ways, I think you have laid the groundwork for me, and for me to follow on tonight. Although I have some different interpretations, but overall, I think we are in agreement. Hallelujah. Thank you so much.
I kind of missed the part where you talked about Rome. I know that they went to Greece and they went up into Rome, but now as Rome is today, what is the connection between the Roman religion and what Esau is doing? And I know they're sometimes they're in cahoots with each other, but
okay. Well, very quick explanation of that is that actually Catholicism is responsible for spreading Islam because they actually created this with Muhammad. Okay. But, ironically, the Catholic Church, I mean, it sprung out of I've got Mahdi on the brain, but there's another M, there's a cult. There was a cult. Mithras. They sprung out of the Mithras cult. And there are many similarities between the Catholic Church and the Edomite Mithras cult. One of them are their holidays. And one of the other notable ones is that they hate women. Islam hates women. And in the Catholic Church, women are not allowed to participate. And pesky things, you know, you can keep them out of a cult that's only for men, but you can't keep them out of a church where they're trying to worship God, right? So the women kept coming in, and they kept wanting to participate, and so the Catholic Church had to create nunneries to keep the women, you know, quiet, keep them over there, keep them. But eventually, Catholicism actually morphed away from Mithras, and even though they later created this this religion and this system, actually, more than just a religion, with Muhammad, there are so many people, there are so many ten tribers. Prodigal son is in the Catholic Church, and it's in the Greek Orthodox Church. And because of that, now the definition for Rome has changed to being the great whore, because a whore is a woman who is committing adultery or spiritual adultery, idolatry, and that's now what the Catholic Church definition is. It changed over time, and the Lord shows us that in the end of days. The Jews call Rome Basra, and Basra is the capital of Edom. There's a clue.
Look at the lineup of World Wars 1 and 2, and you'll see, you will see Edom, and you will see Joseph, or you will see the 10 tribes. It's the same countries, mm-hmm. once, twice, and that's just in the last century.
You illustrated how it was Esau that hacked up Nimrod, and I haven't investigated this, but I've understood that this was the work of Shem.
Yeah.
Could you explain, please?
That's the rabbinical view, that it's the work of Shem, but it is not the scriptural or extra-biblical view.
So you said Iran was Shiite, but you said that the Shiites, for the most part, lived along with the Jewish, but Iran now hates Israel.
It's been changing, yes.
Because of Edomites or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Iran is has been changing over the last 40 or 50 years. They're running out Christians and they're running out Jews now. But by and large, the Shiite nations have a history, a long history, of being pretty peaceable with Christians and Jews. I mean, you can find instances all through history where there were problems. But, you know, in Syria, let's just look at Syria for a minute. What's happening there is that the Jews and the Christians are being run out of that country along with the Shiites. They are fleeing. If they're not in war fighting against either Bashar al-Assad or ISIS, they're fleeing. Yeah, you know, this morning there was a headline about 180,000 people that are fleeing out of Syria. And they don't want them to go. And what they're doing is if they catch you there, they're killing you. They're killing Jews, Christians, and Shiites in Syria.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
What blows me away is the Orthodox Judaism expect their Messiah to come out of the cliffs of Petra. And we read this in the prophets about this prince that comes out dressed in red.
His garment is stained red, yes. And he comes to Basra first. And we'll probably touch on that tomorrow. But, you know, the thing is that the Messiah comes to Basra to open up the sheepfold to let the people out so they can start getting to Jerusalem for Sukkot, to the wedding feast. I'm going to explain how that all works tomorrow.
The point you brought out about how Esau never got to rule and reign in its kingdom, killed Nimrod but never became king, and is now wanting to establish rulership from Babylon but also from Jerusalem, I thought that point was very telling, because we were looking in the news this morning, and in the news today, we're hearing news about how ISIS is closing in on Baghdad. And Baghdad is very likely going to fall to ISIS. And if ISIS gets Baghdad, ISIS will then get all of the weapons and the supplies and the resources that we've been sending to the so-called moderate rebels. And it falls right into the laps of ISIS. And they're going after Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And who's the leader of ISIS? Al-Baghdadi.
Right.
So what you were saying is happening in the news.
Yeah, well, and the other thing about that is, see, the reason they want Baghdad is because it's the closest large city to ancient Babylon. It's only like 55 miles away from the ancient ruins of Babylon.